This is Pentateuch class, I guess just since last Thursday, but it was a long weekend. So we're picking up in the book of Numbers. We'll be starting with chapter 17. And by way of review, the last thing we covered was chapter 16, which that's pretty simple. But the important thing is chapter 16 is what we call Korah's rebellion. It was basically Korah was one of the Levites who was not of the priesthood, but seemed to be jealous and thought he should be. And, you know, he worked with some leaders of the Reubenite clan to stir up, you know, and come against Moses and Aaron saying, you know, all of us are holy. Anybody should be able to go and worship, you know, offer sacrifice at the temple. Moses said, well, you think so? Well, let's go ahead and try it. I'm putting it in my own words. So 250 of the men came with censers and offered incense, and God burned them up. Korah, Moses went and stared him down and basically said, well, look, if I'm just an if God hasn't chosen me, these guys will just die a normal life like nothing's unusual. But if God is working through me, the earth is going to open up and swallow them and close up again. And then that's exactly what happened. And you can imagine people were kind of panicky and scared. So chapter 17 is God choosing another way to show that he did indeed choose the tribe of Levi, and then specifically Aaron and his descendants for the priesthood. As it seems that even with what happened, there might have still been some dispute about it. So we see in 17 verse 1, well, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Israel, get from them a rod from each father's house, all their leaders according to the father's houses, 12 rods. Write each man's name on his rod. So at first we might wonder, well, which father's houses? But it's basically the 12 tribes. And God is going to instigate a demonstration. God started this off. It's not a response to anybody asking him if he could do it. And it's worth noting these rods were, people think, were probably something like we would think of a scepter, a stick. And it's believed it was a symbol of authority, like the leader of the clan or family would have something like that. Probably it derived from the old custom of shepherds. It seems often carried two types of rods. One was the long curved crook that we think of as a shepherd's crook, but also, you know, he would carry that and use it to guide sheep and, if necessary, hook them and pull them somewhere. But the shorter, heavier one was basically a club that the shepherd would use as defense against wild animals or other things like that. And it's thought that over the years, that developed into sort of a ceremonial function, because some of these guys might have been shepherds, but as leaders of their clan and older, they probably weren't doing that. Okay, so having said that, God instructs each leader to put his own name on the staff. Now, we saw 12. There's a question, and it's not what I consider to be an overly important question, but I seem to be a master of trivia in Pentateuch class sometimes. Were there 12 total, including Aaron's rod? And if so, that means there was one for Joseph that covered Ephraim and Manasseh. But I think it might have been more likely there were 12 aside from Levi. So there were 12 and Aaron's rod. As I said, it's a small matter, and I'm not sure it changes anything either way. But if so, then Aaron's would have been a 13th rod. And we'll see in verse 3, you know, and so you got the 12 rods in verse 2, then in verse 3, and you shall write Aaron's name on the rod for Levi. There will be one rod for head of each father's house. Place them in the tabernacle of meeting before the testimony where I'll meet you. So basically put them in the holy place. Not the holy of holies, but a place where only the priests were allowed to go. It'll be that the rod of the man whom I choose will blossom. Thus I'll rid myself of the complaints of the children of Israel, which they make against you. I think it's interesting. This is going to be a demonstration of God's power that doesn't involve killing anyone, which is a nice change. He punished people quite a bit. But you could also say, well, you know, man can kill other men, but only God can give life. And that's what he's going to do. He's going to have these long dead sticks. They've been fashioned into rods who knows how long ago. And God says, I'm going to make one of them blossom and bloom. So he's working a miracle, as I said, of causing life. So they put their rods in the tabernacle, as it says. It doesn't say so, but I would imagine they posted a guard if I were the men of any of the other tribes, I'd say, okay, somebody be here watching to make sure Moses and Aaron don't pull a fast one and sneak in overnight. So assuming there's a guard, you know, they know it's on the up and up. They come back the next morning. Verse 8, on the next day, Moses went into the tabernacle of witness, and behold, the rod of Aaron of the house of Levi had sprouted, put forth buds, had produced blossoms, and yielded ripe almonds. In case you didn't know it, I guess his rod came from an almond tree. There's something I was looking... there's a question, again, a little bit of a trivia. Is this the same rod or staff that Moses used when they brought the plagues on Egypt, and the same one he held over the Red Sea to cause it to part? Some people think it was the same one. Other people think, no, it was probably a different one. Doesn't matter in particular, but later on, this rod has a special destiny. It's going to be preserved. So we notice not only did God make Aaron's rod blossom, but all the way, you know, developed fruit and then ripe nuts. It even shows three stages of development that he caused miraculously to happen: buds, blossoms, and fruit. I point that out, but I don't know that it has any great symbolism in all of those. But it says that he gave all the other men their rods. You know, verse 9, Moses brought out the rods from before the Lord to all the children of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his rod. So I imagine Moses goes, here you go. They look, this looks just the way it did when I brought it here yesterday. Look at Aaron's. Okay, there's a big difference. At this point, who's going to say anything? Yeah, God chose Aaron, and he showed it by something nobody could duplicate. So as a memorial, verse 10, Lord said to Moses, bring Aaron's rod back before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put away their complaints from me, lest I die. So Moses did just as the Lord commanded. There's a point I wanted to make on this. Oh, yeah. So it seems that Aaron's rod, we think, you could argue it both ways. Was it in the holy place where the incense altar and the candelabra and the bread, the table for the showbread was? Or was it actually within the Holy of Holies? And that seems to be true from what we see in Hebrews 9. Hebrews 9, verses 3 and 4. I'm going to flip back there because I didn't double-check the exact wording. Yeah, it says, behind the second veil, the part of the tabernacle which was called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer, the Ark of the Covenant on all sides, was gold, in which were the golden pot that had manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. So there's, again, some people say that this was put actually into the Ark of the Covenant. But another interpretation was that it was put in the holy place there with it, not necessarily inside the ark. And I'm not sure, again, if that matters in particular, but God wanted this saved like he wanted a pot of manna. You have a pat of butter, but a pot of manna. You know, for all time, basically, if anybody has a question, apparently Moses can bring it out and show them. What's interesting, it seems like the people might be despairing, as we see in verse 12, so the children of Israel spoke to Moses, saying, surely we die, we perish, we all perish. Whoever even comes near the tabernacle of the Lord must die. Shall we all die? So we've had this radical shift from the beginning of chapter 16 where they're saying, hey, we're all holy. God called us to be a nation of priests. All of us should be able to come to the tabernacle. Now God has shown that he chose the tribe of Levi and that family of Aaron. And so now the people are at the other extreme saying, if we even get anywhere near there, we're all going to die. So perhaps that's what leads into chapter 18, where God is going to speak to Aaron. And again, this is mostly a repeat, but make clear that he designated, you know, the tribe, the family of Aaron, for the role of the priesthood, that they could come and do things that others couldn't. The Levites were to serve with them and serve the tabernacle. And that Aaronic priesthood would be held responsible if it wasn't done properly. So let's look at that. And one thing I'll note at the beginning of the chapter, then the Lord said to Aaron, you and your sons, your father's house with you, shall bear the iniquity related to the sanctuary. You and your sons with you shall bear the iniquity associated with your priesthood. Now, just reading it, it sounds like, oh, doing this is sinful. Well, that doesn't make sense. You know, why would God appoint them to be a priest and say, oh, you know, it's so bearing iniquity seems to relate more to they're responsible if things get out of order. It's on them to make sure things are done right, and God's about to lay it out what's supposed to be done. I don't know that there's great significance in this, but I find it intriguing that here it says God said to Aaron. And I went and double-checked. Prior to this, we've seen God speak to Moses. And sometimes he'll tell Moses, God will tell Moses something and tell him to go tell Aaron. And some places, God will speak to Moses and Aaron together. This, from what I can tell, is the first time that God spoke just to Aaron. And whether or not Moses is listening in or not, we don't know, but he's not a mediator, and it seems like it's God to Aaron. As I said, I'm not sure, I don't want to build that up more than it needs to be, but it reminds me again of how far Aaron has come since, you know, he was the one who was intimidated into making the golden calf and making excuses about it. We've seen when the plague after Korah's rebellion came, he rushed to appeal to God to save them, going into danger. He stood up to the rebels. Now God is dealing with Aaron. So Aaron has grown and matured perhaps quite a bit. And from there he goes on. Actually, I'm going to summarize this. Verses 2 through 7 show this clear responsibility between the priests and the Levites. So the priest could enter, the tabernacle. They're responsible for the altar and the sanctuary. They're the ones that are allowed to sprinkle blood on the altar and burn parts of the animals. The Levites take care of pretty much all the rest of the tabernacle. And there it says they have to serve the priest. I hope the priest didn't take that, get puffed up and become overbearing and have them shining their shoes and things like that. Probably not, because we think they worked barefoot. But so there's a clear delineation of these responsibilities. And there's going to be, God's going to make sure that they're taken care of in doing this job for him. I wanted to make a point. Yeah, verse 6, behold, I myself, so this is God's decision, have taken your brethren, the Levites, from among the children of Israel. They are a gift to you, given by the Eternal to do the work of the tabernacle of meeting. We remember, after the Passover, God had said, I spared the firstborn, but the firstborn belonged to me. Then we went a little further, and God said, I'll take the Levites instead of the firstborn. And the number was almost the same. They had to pay to make up for the difference. So God is saying, the Levites belong to me. I'm devoting them to the service of the house of Aaron, his priesthood. Verse 7, therefore you and your sons with you shall attend your priesthood for everything at the altar and behind the veil you shall serve. I give you your priesthood to you as a gift for a service. But the outsider who comes near shall be put to death. Okay, so there's the distinction. As we saw at the end of chapter 17, some of the people were worried, what's going to happen? Are we all going to die? God gives the clear orders. These people are allowed to come in there, no one else. You're allowed to be in certain areas, so it's not a great mystery. I don't think it should have been before that. If we want to draw a spiritual lesson that applies to the church today, the one I would think of is the fact that God puts people in different positions, at different times, as he chooses to do. As it says in 1 Corinthians 12, it lists these different offices and different gifts. And, Paul clearly said not all are teachers. Some are and some aren't, but we're reminded James chapter 3 and verse 1, James said, the teachers would have a stricter judgment. So be careful about wanting to have that role, which again, I'm telling it to you, but it applies to me most of all. So it's a serious thing. But, God does that. He'll call certain people to certain positions, and he can make changes. Move people in, move them around for our own good, for the most part. Remind me that I said that if I get reassigned and sent out to, be the pastor someplace that I don't necessarily like. I need to remember the words I'm telling you here and now. It works that way. But I also remember, it's like, hey, I'm absolutely thrilled that I get to be at ABC. I mean, I've got one of the best jobs in the church, but I didn't ask for it. I didn't turn it down, but, I was just told, here's what you got to go and do. So it's sort of like Aaron was told, this is what you've got to do. I got to be careful. I don't want to equate myself with Aaron. That might be stretching it a bit. Anyways, let's move on. Again, I'll summarize the next several verses. Verses 8 through 19, God will reiterate. And I'm saying reiterate because this isn't new information. It's been covered before. But certain portions of the sacrifices belong to the priest. And I was like the right shoulder and parts like that were always the priests. And also the first fruits. The firstborn of animals and of people were devoted to God. So if it's an animal that could be sacrificed, they were to bring it to the priest and let him sacrifice it. If it's an unclean animal, it should be redeemed. Or if I remember correctly, have its neck broken. Humans had to be redeemed. You're not allowed to break their necks. But these all come to the priest. So God, as we saw earlier, he made it clear that those things belong to him. So God's not saying, well, they belong to you, Aaron. He said, they belong to me. I'm putting them in your care. I'm giving them to you. That's important to remember because we'll see, you know, especially when it comes to tithes, that can change later. Matter of fact, I want to go to verse 20. Then the Eternal said to Aaron, you shall have no inheritance in their land, nor shall you have any portion among them. I'm your portion and your inheritance among the children of Israel. So, you know, Aaron might have a nifty job in some ways, but the whole point of them leaving Egypt and going up to the promised land was get the promised land. They're going to inherit this land and be able to grow great crops and have a happy life. So, you know, it's good for all the people, but Aaron and the Levites, they don't get to inherit land. And they're going to have to rely on God and have faith in him. Moving on to verse 21. Behold, I've given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel as an inheritance in return for the work they'll perform in the tabernacle of meeting. Hereafter, the children of Israel shall not come near the tabernacle of meeting, lest they bear sin and die. But the Levites will perform the work of the tabernacle of meeting. And it goes on from there. Yeah, in verse 24, it says that the tithes of the children of Israel, which they offer up as a heave offering to the Eternal, I have given to the Levites as an inheritance. And therefore, I've said they have no inheritance. So the Levites weren't given land. What did they get? Actually, there's two things. One, I just read. You know, they get the tithe, so the Levites receive the tithes from the people. It's worth noting they also would be given cities. It says cities, but really the size of them, they were more like villages. But rather than one block, and I'm trying to remember if any of these maps divide up. You know, you see basically where the, you know, here you have Judah and Ephraim, Benjamin, Manasseh. Where's Gad? They're up. Anyways, each of the tribe had their area, but not Levi. They're scattered throughout Israel and given various villages or cities, 48 of them. And I'm saying this as though you've heard it before because you did in the book of Joshua. Book of Joseph. Still catching up. And each of those, they would be 4,000 square cubits of land for the village with 2,000 more around them. Not enough really to work and become prosperous. They had to rely on Israel giving the tithes. I did note there in verse 21, God said, I've given the children of Levi all the tithes. That's interesting because so basically the children of Israel had to turn it over. It was God's, but God was giving it to the Levites. I just realized I don't have a scripture here, but in Hebrews, Paul will make the case that, okay, because there's a change in the priesthood, there's a change in the law. And if I remember correctly, the Greek that translated change could also be, could have been put as a transfer. So the tithes always belong to God, but when the Levitical priesthood is no longer functioning, in the era of his church, he said, okay, the tithes are mine, I'm going to give them to my church to do the work that God wants. And that's not a new concept. Tithes is the fundamental doctrines, but I thought I'd reiterate it here. I was going to make a reference to something in Deuteronomy chapter 14. Because the important thing is, okay, all the tithes given to Levi. In Deuteronomy 14, verse 22, it says, you'll tithe of the increase of your grain that the field produces and eat before the Lord in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of the grain. But it's worth remembering here, okay, God gave all the tithe to Levi. here he's saying, save the tithe and go eat it at the feast. Well, they can't both be true unless there's more than one tithe. And hence we call this the second tithe. And a little bit later, it talks about storing up your tithe, and every third year you give it to the widow and the stranger and the orphan. And we see that as referring to what we call the third tithe, which was done, you know, every third year, or a lot of people believe it was the third and sixth year of a seven-year cycle. So that, you know, the land Sabbath still is in there. And something actually I learned when I spent about a year and a half reading the works of Josephus, which was enlightening in some ways, but a chore in others. But Josephus describes the tithing system of ancient Israel exactly the way we teach it. And I thought, that's interesting. You know, he was there to see it in person. And I say it's worth noting because there are people in different organizations that will explain tithing very differently than we teach it. And I think they teach it incorrectly. I think ours is correct, obviously. And so historically, we've got somebody that wrote 2,000 years ago who was much closer to the system, who saw the scriptures as meaning what we see them to mean. Okay, I spent more time on that than I intended, but I think that's okay. Okay, so looking at verse 25, I'll make this point, okay? We've seen all the Israelites tithe to the Levites. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak thus to the Levites, and say to them, when you take from the children of Israel the tithes, which I've given you from them as your inheritance, you shall offer up a heave offering of it to the Eternal, a tenth of the tithe. So the Levites, because they live on the tithe, doesn't mean they don't have to tithe themselves. So the Levites receive the tithe from the people. They take one-tenth of that, and they give it to the priests. So the Levites live on the tithes, but they also, you know, tithe themselves. And later on, actually, in verse 31, it mentions, you may eat it in any place, you and your households. It's your reward for your work in the tabernacle. You shall bear no sin because of it when you've lifted up the best of it. He's making the point that, okay, it's like holy, it's devoted to God when the people send in their tithe. But God is saying to the Levites, okay, you don't have to only eat it at the tabernacle. It's your income, so you treat it as normal income, except the tithe that you give to the priests. Did you see what I mean there? So for them, the tithe that the Levites get is as though they're getting a paycheck, and they can treat it as normal income. I haven't figured out yet if the priest had to tithe. If so, the only thing I think of is they would give it directly to God. I mean, not like hand it to him, because I don't think he was accepting that, but they might have offered it as a sacrifice or something. Again, I haven't done a lot of study to find out, but I've had the question in my mind that Dr. Britt's looking. I felt your face would light up if you had an answer that you'd seen.
There's no direct statement.
Okay, that's what I thought. I haven't heard of a custom. Yeah, Kayla?
Probably an obvious question, but I assume ministers tithe.
Yes. Actually, I was going to mention that. Yeah, ministers, we do that same here. Matter of fact, I wrote a check for my tithes last night. You know, I usually save mine for a couple pay periods, and then I calculate and, you know, write a check and mail it in. Or actually, here I don't have to mail it. I can just walk upstairs and put it in a slot. So, yeah, I mean, the same principle. Even though, you know, employees of the church live from money that's been tithed, we see it as our responsibility to tithe and, you know, save second tithe and third tithe is explained in a different way, which when we get to Deuteronomy, I'll discuss it, but Mr. McNeely might have gone over it by then. Okay, so other questions or thoughts? I'm not meaning just barrel along full speed, but also don't want to dawdle. Nobody says dawdle much anymore. Okay, chapter 19. And chapter 19, I'll just mention, this is one of the most mysterious parts of the ritual system. You know, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron saying, so now he's speaking to both of them, this is the ordinance of the law which the Eternal has commanded, saying, speak to the children of Israel that they bring you a red heifer without blemish, in which there is no defect and on which a yoke has never come. Okay, so it shows it's a public offering, not an individual, but it's, you know, I'm not sure how they would rotate, but I don't know how often they would need a red heifer. As a population group, perhaps more often. this is the only sacrifice within the system where not only is the breed specified and the sex, but even the color. Often God will say a male of the sheep or a female of the goats or something, but here he specifies the color. Now, I'll mention this. Generally, I see red as being like an auburn color. You see that in cattle at times. A Jewish tradition arose later, and I'm not sure when, that the rabbi, well, not rabbis, but you know, somebody in the priest would have to check every hair of that cow to make sure all of them were that color. But I don't see that here in the book of Numbers. But it comes up now because, you know, there are those, you know, who want to reinstate a sacrificial system, and some say the sign that it's God is ready for it to happen is he'll send a red heifer. And when I've seen, some years ago there was a TV show loosely based on prophecies of the Bible and end time, and it started off with, it's a red heifer. Everybody was so excited that they found one. And it's like, well, I'm not sure. I think we could find plenty of red heifers, you know, if we're not worried about every single hair. And as I said, probably an auburn color. Don't imagine this cow looking like Clifford the Red Dog. You know, not necessarily that kind of, not an unnatural red that would never happen. Okay. Now, this is, well, I want to summarize. I got a lot of things I want to say. In essence, this is going to be used for creating what's called the water of purification. So the water of purification, we've already seen a few places where it's described being used, but I mentioned, well, later in chapter 19, we'll see how it's to be made. And it's talked about purifying and removing iniquity by sprinkling this water of purification. But I want to remind us from the outset that that's symbolic. 1 John chapter 1 and verse 7 reminds us we're cleansed by the sacrifice of Christ. So Jesus Christ's sacrifice, his shed blood is the only thing that can cleanse us of sin. So the sacrifices all come in symbolically. But we see this one mentioned. Actually, I'm going to turn to Hebrews chapter 9 to see a particular point because this one is mentioned. Hebrews 9, beginning in verse 13. Yeah, for if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean, okay, that's what we're going to discuss in chapter 19 of Numbers, the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean, if that sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? That's a rather wordy way of saying, you know, this thing with the red heifer and the water of purification was looking ahead to Christ's sacrifice, the real sacrifice. But I haven't discussed what we're doing yet, so let's go back to Numbers 19. So you get the red heifer, you give it to Eleazar the priest. He's going to take it outside the camp, and it'll be slaughtered before him, and Eleazar will take some of the blood with his finger and sprinkle some of its blood seven times directly in front of the altar. So the heifer is actually taken outside the camp and slaughtered. Then Eleazar has got to bring some of the blood back into the tabernacle to sprinkle it. But the whole thing is done outside the camp. A couple things. Well, I'm not going to turn back to Hebrews, but in Hebrews 13, verses 11 through 13, mention that Christ was slain outside the camp and refers back to, you know, this ceremony being done outside the camp. What was the verse? Hebrews 13, 11 through 13. So the symbolism is still there. At least, and I wouldn't have made the connection if not Paul making the point, you know, Christ was taken outside the city to Golgotha where he was crucified, and that's where he died. And Paul said, that red heifer had to be taken outside the camp to be slaughtered. And why Eleazar and not Aaron, do you think? Actually, there's an important reason that I haven't read yet, so maybe I should go a little further. Yeah, let's say verse 5, the heifer shall be burned in his sight. This is still Eleazar. Its hide, its flesh, its blood, its offal shall be burned. So all of it's burned entirely, none of it separated, all the way burned to ash. And the priest shall take cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet and cast them in the midst of the burning heifer. So these things are added and they're burned up also, so it's part of the ashes. Cedar That word, that's the word in English, but most scholars think that was a type of a juniper tree or a smaller tree. And it's interesting, some speculation, because they say the oil from a juniper would irritate the skin, you know, and might make you rub your hands because it kind of feels bad. And hyssop was this kind of bushy plant they used to sprinkle things, but they say it was related to a mint plant, and that hyssop oil was actually an effective antiseptic. And I don't know what carvacol is, but they said its oil was 50% carvacol, which would kill bacteria and fungus. Yeah. Oh, I didn't know they cooked with it. Which reminds us again, okay, it's not poisonous. One of the points is, you know, okay, cedar is not poisonous. You don't eat it because it's not necessarily healthy. Neither is hyssop. We don't know about what exactly scarlet was, but there's no indication that it's something. And I think of this because of that trial by ordeal for if a man suspected his wife cheated on him. And I made the point, you use some of these ashes, you know, some of that water, and there was nothing poisonous about it that we know of. That ritual was seemed to be relying on God to work a miracle to show her guilty. But the default would be nothing would happen to her. Anyways, I'll make that point now. As I said, this, you know, maybe if the oil from the juniper would irritate the skin, if the hyssop had some antiseptic qualities. You know, we can speculate about that, but I'm not sure if any of that would survive being burnt to ashes. So, as I said, some scholars had extra time on their hand and looked into that, but in the end, you just come up with these ashes, whatever they are, but you're going to use those. But I left off something I meant to cover earlier. In verse 7, then the priest shall wash his clothes, bathe in water, and he'll come into the camp, and the priest will be unclean until evening. And the one who burns will wash his clothes in water and bathe in water and be unclean till evening. So everybody involved in this does their part, and that makes them unclean. They've got to go wash and be unclean till evening. Verse 9, then a man who is clean gathers up the ashes of the heifer and stores them outside the camp. They'll be kept for the congregation of Israel for the water of purification. But as it says in verse 10, the one who gathered the ashes, he's unclean until evening. This is why I think God said Eleazar needs to do this, not Aaron, because he doesn't want his high priest to become unclean by being involved in this. So the high priest doesn't become unclean for any reason willingly. You know, even a funeral, you know, it's almost nobody that he can defile himself for. So the next in line is his oldest son. And I've read in some sources they say that the next in line would be called the second priest. So you have the high priest and then the second priest. And so he does this, and then the ashes are for making water of purification. But there's one part we're still missing. The water. Okay, so it's worth noting that. They have this stored there, and it's almost like, you know, I'm going to say powdered water. You know, you have this, you get water of purification, just add water. But you do have to bring your own water, and it's a particular type. It goes on to talk about, anyone who touches a dead body, this is going to be used for someone who becomes unclean. I'm looking, and I want to make sure I haven't already read over it. Maybe not. Because somebody who's unclean, they have to go outside the camp and sprinkle this, you know, water of purification on the third day and on the seventh, and then he's clean. And God says, if you don't, you're not going to be clean. Eventually, you're going to be cut off. Yes, Andrew?
Real quick, in my concordance, the word body in verse 11 is translated to literally soul of man.
A what man?
Soul of man.
Oh, soul, yeah. Now, I'm curious, because normally that would be nefesh, which refers to the body, and that's sometimes translated as soul.
Yeah, it just says soul of man. I just didn't know if there's any...
I don't think so. I think it's a matter... Well, the reason this comes up, perhaps, is because, you know, some religions believe that we have an immortal soul, but we believe our bodies are a very mortal soul. So, but it's that one word is used. So that would be my guess without having researched it. Yeah, actually, what I wanted to get, there's a discussion of several verses here. I mentioned verses 12 all the way through 15 and 16 talk about things that can make someone clean or unclean. And if, like, there's a dead body in a tent, it makes a difference. Is everything in there clean, declared unclean? Well, if it's inside a container that's closed and sealed, then not. But if the container is open, everything in it's unclean. And of course, this isn't going to encourage, don't have dead bodies laying around. It's going to make everything unclean. So this encourages, you know, quick, you know, get the bodies disposed of. We could see this as probably, you know, it would have a sanitary effect. You know, we understand about germs that can be translated, bacteria and such. They wouldn't necessarily have known that. And I mention that as perhaps a reason that God gave, but the overriding reason seems to be the symbolism. You know, God didn't want death associated with his people. And death was seen as the opposite, well, it is the opposite of life, but, you know, dead bodies and such, you know, make someone ceremonially unclean. Okay, I found what I was looking for, that the add water part. And I wanted to point this out because in verse 17 it says, "For an unclean person, they'll take some of the ashes of the red heifer for purification, and running water shall be put on them in a vessel." Doesn't say how much of the ashes, but maybe a handful, maybe a pinch. You put it in, and then running water. Some translations use the word living water. But it basically means water from a flowing source, like a stream or a creek, not from a cistern or, you know, a stagnant mud puddle or anything like that. It has to be fresh water, we would say. And, of course, I'm not sure how we'd view water from a faucet, but they didn't have faucets then. Danny?
Is this the same water that they're talking about? Of water, I'm assuming the water of purification is something different that they have at the tabernacle.
Well, no, I think it is.
It's the same?
Yeah. If it's something different, it's not described. So I make the assumption that it either is the same or God left something out that we didn't need to know.
I guess my other question is, too, So we were talking about the sprinkling of the blood seven times in order for the law of purification, that's to make this water? Is that what you were saying?
Well, that's part of the blood from the heifer is sprinkled, but then all the rest of it is burned up to ashes. So the blood is presented at the altar, you know, I guess symbolizing it's part of this process, but then it's all turned to ash with the cedar or juniper, the scarlet and hyssop. They're mixed together, and some of those ashes mixed with water from a living, you know, running source makes water of purification.
Oh, okay, that was my question.
So, yeah, that's okay. I mentioned earlier, okay, it's like powdered water. You have to add water, and I wanted to add, he had a particular a rule about the water. I couldn't think of the word I was trying to think of.
And then the other thing was, could you go over one more time why it was Eleazar?
Oh, my guess is because taking part in the ceremony would make him unclean until evening. So I think God didn't want the high priest to become unclean. He wants the high priest to never defile himself but stay clean, so somebody else in the priesthood is designated to do that job, even though he's only unclean for part of a day, it would seem. Okay. Now, I realize I skimmed across this, but chapters 18 and 19, as I said, mostly deal with things that aren't in effect right now. Now, to the degree that God reinstates the ritual system in the millennium, to whatever extent that he might, we might need to become more aware of this, but we'll be able to ask him personally when that time comes. So for now, as I said, the symbolism reminds us of looking to Jesus Christ and his sacrifice, and we realize, you know, if defilement or uncleanness is related to anything, it is to sin. I mentioned death, but remember the wages of sin is death. So God doesn't want us to become unclean by being involved in sin. But we don't have to go burn up a heifer. You know, we can claim the sacrifice of Christ, and you know, if we're repentant and God does forgive. Okay, chapter 20, we're going to jump ahead a little. Not in the book, but in time-wise. Chapter 20, verse 1, "Then the children of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there." We don't get a whole lot more about this. We believe this is the second time they came to Kadesh. And there's discussion. This shows Kadesh here in the wilderness of Zin, so south of the promised land. And it's generally thought that this is the same area or very close to where they camped when they sent up the scouts, you know, the 12 scouts to check out the promised land. They came back and gave a bad report. Now they're here again, but we believe it's approximately 38 years later. That's where I said we're taking a leap. It doesn't tell us that. So some might put a different interpretation. They might say maybe Miriam died early in the 40 years of wandering. But most of the sources I've studied say, no, they think this is, we've jumped ahead. Miriam is probably, well, she's about 10 years older than Moses, is the general thought. We don't know for certain. We know Aaron was 3 years older than Moses, and Miriam was enough older that when Moses was a baby, she could walk around on her own and talk to the daughter of Pharaoh. So if that's true, Miriam is probably about 130 years old or so when she dies, which is, you know, pretty long, full life. Looking back, what happened before this? If we leaped ahead 30-some years, what's been going on? Well, apparently packing up and moving, unpacking, setting up camp, picking up, moving again, gathering manna, you know, beating it into flour and cooking things, and it basically just life goes on. And during the course of this, most of the older generation, those 20 years older or older, have died, or we'll see there's going to be a fair bit of dying coming up. They will before they enter the promised land. I'll mention Ezekiel chapter 20. Ezekiel 20, verses 13 through 24, summarize the entire time in the wilderness as a time of testing, you know, and occasional rebellion and punishment. So I take that as the best summary we have. You know, okay, God was testing them in the wilderness all those years, and we've seen examples of rebellion and punishment. Ezekiel 20, verses 13 to 24. So now we're here at Kadesh, and it says in verse 2, there was no water for the congregation, so they gathered against Moses and Aaron. That's not mentioned when they were there 38 years earlier. So we don't know why there's no mention of not having water the first time, you know, but now there is a problem. Some, it might have been that there were springs and they dried up. Maybe it was a dry season and the springs just didn't have water in them, or they were just over, you know, worn out from overuse. Again, we don't know, but this is a younger generation for the most part, but like their fathers, they tend to lack faith and be complainers. I can say, just like my generation and the generation before me and you guys after us, at times we're complainers and we lack faith. They gathered against Moses and Aaron, verse 3. The people contended with Moses and spoke, "If only we died when our brethren died before the Lord. Why have you brought the assembly of the Lord up into this wilderness? We and our animals should die here. Why did you make us come out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It's not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates. And there's not any water to drink." I'm putting that in my own words a little bit, but remember, they've been told all along, after this punishment is over, we're going to go in the promised land. It's going to be a land flowing with milk and honey. They probably have the reports from the scouts. And remember, Joshua and Caleb are still around. They don't die. So they can tell them, yeah, it's great stuff, pomegranates and figs and, you know, all kinds of good stuff. And they're saying, all we see here is sand and rocks and no water. And they're complaining about having had to leave Egypt. Perhaps this legend of Egypt having been a nice place to live where they had everything they needed continued into the next generation. And probably the parents didn't talk so much about how miserable it was being a slave who had to make bricks and go gather their own straw. We don't know. But verse 6, we'll see Moses and Aaron do what they've done many times. They went to from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle, and they fell on their faces. Again, they prostrate themselves in prayer to seek God humbly, and the glory of God appears. And the Lord spoke to Moses. Okay, they do need water. God's going to provide. Take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, and gather the congregation together. Speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. And thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock and give drink to the congregation of their animals. Verse 9, it says, Moses took the rod from before the Eternal. that indicates to me this is probably the same rod that we just saw in chapter 17 that was Aaron's rod that budded, which I wonder what it looked like if Moses is bringing this thing out and it's got branches and leaves and almonds waving around. I don't know, but they might have said, oh, I heard stories about that from my parents that, you know, it was a dead rod and it budded. Anyways, God gives them clear instructions. These instructions differ from the first time God brought water out of a rock. If you want the reference, it was back in Exodus chapter 17. Exodus 17, verses 5 and 6. And you probably remember, what was Moses supposed to do that time? Okay, take the rod and hit the rock with it. It doesn't specify which rock, but probably a prominent rock. Okay, but Moses and Aaron made a mistake here. Actually, we'll read. Now, I already said they took the rod. Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together and said, "Here now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?" Sounds like they're taking a lot on themselves, although God did say, you know, in verse 8, "You will bring water." So it's not necessarily so bad that they were taking maybe more credit than they should have, but I don't know, I'd say their attitude and tone of voice matters here. Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice, and water came out abundantly. Congregation, their animals drank. But, you know, there's a problem. We'll attend that earlier, but Moses and Aaron did two things different from what God commanded them. What do you think, Nate?
He only told them to speak to the rock.
Okay, he told them to speak to the rock, and they hit it. Okay, there's another thing they did wrong. Yeah? Okay, well, they did it twice. I was, they spoke, but did they speak to the rock? They spoke to the people. Actually, they were kind of shouting at the people. So the way, and this is maybe a picky breakdown. It's not something I would test you on, but you know, they spoke to the people when God told them to speak to the rock, and God told them to speak to the rock, but they hit the rock. Interestingly, I think maybe because of the relationship God had with them, God backed them up. Now, they're going to pay a price. There's going to be a penalty, but God didn't make it public. He didn't embarrass them in front of the whole nation and then say, come back here, I've got to make you do it right. God sent the water. And then when he gets Moses and Aaron in private, he tells them in verse 12, because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore, you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I've given them. This is the water of Meribah, because the children of Israel contended with the Lord. He was hallowed among them. Let me wrap this up real quickly, but when it says you didn't believe me, I think they fully believed that God would give water. But it seems they didn't have faith. Well, maybe they didn't believe God meant to do it exactly the way he said. That's one thought. Or maybe, you know, they didn't believe the water would come by only speaking. They felt like they needed to hit it. Or it seems the biggest part is that they didn't hallow God. They didn't give him the proper credit and respect that was due. They were taking more credit for themselves, and God just said, there's a price to be paid for that. The congregation gets the water. Yeah, I've got in my notes, Moses and Aaron might have, in this case, got the what I call the "but this is me" syndrome. You know, the "but this is me" happens whenever there's a rule or we're supposed to do things a certain way. And we say, well, I know that's the rule, but this is me. I've got a reason. I've got this or that. All of us do that sometime or another, and I'm not exempted at all. But it's something we want to watch for because it doesn't make it okay. I'll just mention where it says Meribah. That's the Hebrew, it means strife or contention. So it's named the place of Meribah, strife or contention. So we'll pick up from there next time.